This video is sponsored by Squarespace. Pork has got to be the most polarizing meat, possibly the most polarizing food. Pork is, by some reckoning, the most popular meat in the world, accounting for more than a third of global meat consumption. Yet at the same time, about a third of humanity studiously avoids eating pigs. Now, I can't find any hard data on that last point, that's just a guess, but Islam, of course, strictly forbids eating pork. Hinduism is not wild about pork. It's safe to say that a very large share of humanity thinks that this very popular food is inherently unclean. And why? Nobody knows why. I mean, you might have a reason for yourself why you regard pork as unclean, but I'm here to tell you that anthropologists and archaeologists and theologians have all been arguing about the historical origins of the pork taboo for a really long time, and there is no clear scholarly consensus on the matter. Or rather, there is a consensus that we really aren't sure where the pork taboo comes from historically. We get very little help from the primary sources. Here in the Torah is where we first see pork taboo codified in Abrahamic religious law, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, both written down somewhere in the first millennium BCE. Ancient Jewish law says pork is bad because pigs have a cloven hoof but don't chew their cud. And what does that even mean? Well, cloven hoof means a hoof divided into multiple toes. Here's a horse hoof. It's all one piece. It has no toes. Here's a deer hoof. It's got multiple toes. It is cloven. Cows, goats, and sheep all have cloven hoofs. And ancient Israelites had no problem with eating cows and sheep and goats. Why? Because in addition to having a cloven hoof, they also chew their cud. And what does that mean? Well, one of the biggest differences between you and me and goatee here is that goatee can digest grass and other foods comprised primarily of cellulose. Cellulose is this really big sugar that makes up the main structural bulk of most plants, and we simply cannot digest it. It's just fiber. It passes right through us. But ruminants, like goatee, swallow grass whole. Bacteria in their guts start fermenting or breaking down the cellulose, and then comes the gross part. Goatee barfs up some of that fermented grass and then chews on it to break it down further before swallowing it again. That is what it means for an animal to cheweth the cud. Pigs don't do that. Pig and human digestive systems are very similar. They basically eat what we eat. Leviticus and Deuteronomy say pork is bad because pigs have a cloven hoof but don't chew their cud. This book says absolutely nothing about why that is bad, and this book is even less help. The Quran here just says that unless you're starving to death, the flesh of swine is forbidden, along with carrion and blood. But some people find a context clue there. Carrion is rotten meat, usually from an animal that died on its own instead of you slaughtering it. And carrion is particularly likely to harbor dangerous pathogens and toxins. Likewise, blood is particularly likely to harbor pathogens. That said, you can kill them through cooking them, just like you can with any freshly slaughtered animal product. People eat blood all the time. But a lot of people look at this list and naturally assume that the prohibition against pork must have been some kind of ancient health and safety code. This is a theory that gained a lot of traction in the 19th century when scientists first made the link between the parasitic disease trichinosis and the roundworms often found in undercooked pork. Trichinosis was really pervasive in Europe and the Americas in the 19th century. And at that same historical moment, intellectuals in the West were really eager to reconcile religious teaching with their newfound scientific knowledge. And the new understanding of trichinosis imbued a kind of scientific logic into the Old Testament, and that was something that was very attractive to people at the time. But more recent scholarship casts a lot of doubt on the trichinosis theory. The American anthropologist Marvin Harris wrote a very influential book in the 1980s on meat taboos. "My contention," he writes, "is that there is absolutely nothing exceptional about pork as a source of human disease. All domestic animals are potentially hazardous to human health." That much, of course, is indisputably true, and may have been even more true in the ancient world, before we had vaccines for things like anthrax. Anthrax is a horrible bacterial infection that herd animals like cattle and sheep can pass to humans. There is no evidence at all that trichinosis was particularly pervasive in the ancient Middle East, and there's no evidence that ancient Middle Easterners even knew of its existence. In contrast, there is evidence that ancient people knew about anthrax. Anthrax may have been the fifth plague of Egypt discussed in the Book of Exodus here, and Homer may have been talking about anthrax in the Iliad. There's nothing like that for trichinosis, and Harris argues there's a reason for that. Meat parasites cause relatively mild illnesses in people. Most cases are asymptomatic, and the more serious problems can take years to unfold. It's not like a poison that kills you within hours of ingesting it. It would have been really hard for ancient people to make any link between meat and the parasitic diseases that it can sometimes cause. And of course, there's no particular evidence that trichinosis was bad in the Middle East. There's no particular evidence that trichinosis was any worse than any other parasitic disease caused by any other meat. It's simply the case that trichinosis was bad in 19th century Europe and America when this theory was hatched. This is a simple case, Harris argues, of modern people projecting their own experiences onto the lives of ancient people. One of the earliest written specific arguments as to why pork is bad comes from the Middle Ages, from Maimonides. Maimonides was a philosopher who bridged the Jewish and Islamic worlds. He was a Sephardic Jewish rabbi in service of an Islamic ruler, Salah ad-Din Yusuf, or Saladin as he's known here in the West. Maimonides was Saladin's court physician in Egypt, and here's what he wrote about the pork taboo about 800 years ago. "The principal reason why the law forbids swine's flesh is to be found in the circumstances that its habits and its foods are very dirty and loathsome. If it were allowed to eat swine's flesh, the streets and houses would be dirtier than any cesspool, as may be seen in the country of the Franks." Maimonides there is literally talking shit about the Crusaders. Indeed, pigs are more conspicuously gross than most farm animals. They eat anything. They eat trash, they eat roadkill, they even eat human excrement. And they wallow around in mud, potentially even their own excrement. Is this appetizing to you? Probably not. But here's the big question. Humans are universally revolted by filth. They are not universally revolted by pigs. And why not? Well, one explanation may be that pigs do not universally love filth. Pigs only resort to filth when we humans leave them no other option. This right here is the theory that Martin Harris finds most persuasive. The ancient Middle East used to have a lot more trees, and when wild or domesticated pigs hang around in forests, they're not nearly as gross. They root around at the base of trees for seeds and nuts and truffles and things that you and I would be happy to eat, and they don't need to wallow in the mud because they have shade. Contrary to what the expression "sweating like a pig" would lead you to believe, pigs have no sweat glands, and they have small lungs, so panting is not a great way for them to shed excess heat. In hot, sunny climates, like here in the American South, basically the only way for pigs to get cool is to cover themselves in mud. Given the option, they'll wallow in clean mud, but if they have to, they will wallow in their own excrement. The theory goes that over the course of the Iron Age, population growth in the Middle East resulted in deforestation and desertification. Pigs started to have to wallow to stay cool. Then came urbanization, thousands and thousands of humans living on top of each other and filling their streets and their city dumps with food scraps and people poo, all of which attracted pigs who were more than happy to make use of those discarded calories. As people in the Middle East increasingly came to see pigs in this new, unflattering context, they started to view pork as inherently unclean. And what's worse, pigs in this context may have come to compete with humans for food. Because remember, pigs can't eat grass. They like the same kinds of foods we eat, like, you know, grains. In, say, ancient Rome, the environment was simply less arid and more rich with food. Pigs and humans didn't compete. Instead, urban pigs cleaned the streets of waste and converted it into delicious protein. That same natural synergy helped make pork the favorite meat of rapidly urbanizing China to this day. Harris argues that in the comparatively arid Middle East, pigs became both gross and uneconomical. A double whammy. The religious prohibitions followed. Pretty persuasive argument, right? But there are counter-arguments. Goats also eat absolutely anything, including poop. Jews and Muslims have no religious opposition at all to eating goat, nor do they have any problem eating chicken, despite chicken coops being almost as gross as pigsties, and despite chickens not being able to live on grass either. Those chickens are eating grain, grain that I could be eating instead, directly. They're competing with me, but maybe a little bit less than pigs would. Some more recent scholarship indicates that chickens may have simply supplanted pork in the Middle Eastern diet because they do what pigs do, only better. This is a 2015 paper from the archaeologist Richard Redding at the University of Michigan. He argues that chickens can live in cramped urban spaces, just like pigs. They convert food scraps into protein, just like pigs, but they do it more efficiently. They make eggs in addition to meat. Pigs don't do that. And chickens are smaller, which means you can just kill one, cook it, and eat the whole thing immediately. That's a big bonus in a hot climate where meat goes bad really fast once you've slaughtered the animal. Redding argues that chickens were just better suited to the Middle East than pigs were. They simply got there later, and when they did, they supplanted pigs. But if that were true, why would you need a religious prohibition against pigs? Wouldn't people just naturally do the thing that worked better? Well, one thing more recent archaeology shows is that pig eating never really stopped in the Middle East, and it wasn't just limited to non-Israelites like the Philistines. Ancient Jews in various parts of the region ate pig, which makes sense, right? Nobody makes laws against things that nobody is doing. What's clear is that once the pork taboo took hold, it became a way for people to distinguish themselves from other people. Indeed, this is another pretty recent paper I've been showing you where archaeologists found Israelites from the Northern Kingdom were probably still eating pork when they migrated into the Southern Kingdom around the turn of the 7th century BCE. The law we see in the Torah might have been a mechanism of assimilating these Northern Jews into the Southern culture that eschewed pork. In time, the pork taboo became a way for the Israelites to distinguish themselves from the Romans. And then it became a way for the Muslims, who inherited the Abrahamic tradition, to distinguish themselves from, say, those dirty crusading Franks with their filthy streets. It's easy to imagine why the pork taboo spread and why it persists to the point where my pork recipes here in this global platform get noticeably fewer views than my other meat recipes. But where the pork taboo first came from, nobody knows for sure. What I do know for sure is that people of all religions and dietary codes can make a beautiful and functional website with Squarespace. Whether you want to spread the good word of your particular faith tradition or just sell some widgets, Squarespace can help you throw together a website with just a few simple ingredients. Really, all you need are some pictures and something to say. You choose a template, you replace their stock imagery with yours, and you get typing. Once you've got your design, Squarespace helps you run your site. Whether you need to take credit cards, take appointments, or send out email blasts, all of those functions are built right in here. Squarespace is the only company you'll have to deal with when it comes to managing your web presence. And you can play around with a template right now for free. You don't even have to put down a credit card on file. But once you're ready to publish or to register a custom domain, you can do us both a favor and save 10% by going to squarespace.com/ragusea. That link of mine is in the description. Thank you, Squarespace. And you know, thank you, piggies.